But what happens when you die? I guess if you ask 20 people what happens when you die, you'd get 20 different answers, wouldn't you? There's lots of theories around, though no one really seems to know. Lots of people seem to think that there must be some sort of good, maybe not a god, but at least some sort of life force, some sort of spirit that may be returned to somewhere after death. Other people think, well, we perhaps return to Mother Earth. We'd like to be buried under a tree and somehow be recycled and live on in creation. And other people think there's nothing, but they still want to live on through their memories or through their influence that they've had on other people to still have some lasting way of surviving. But generally, though, in all the different theories, they're all positive experiences after death. There's a belief in heaven, however it's defined, but certainly not a belief in hell. And even Christians sometimes dismiss the warnings of hell spoken of by Jesus and others in the New Testament and prefer somehow to imagine that everyone will get into heaven. So a question we want to ask this morning, and as we look at this passage, is whether can we, by turning away from God in this world, can we be cut off from God's loving presence in the next? Or will God just welcome everybody into heaven? Well, if you have the passage open, it's Exodus chapter 33 on page 92. And this is the last part of Exodus that we're looking at in our series. And if you've been here every week, you'll remember the story. The Israelites were enslaved in Egypt, where the Egyptians were harsh taskmasters. And God liberated his people, set them free from the bondage to slavery, and drew them out marvelously. And having done that, he promised them that they would be his people and he would be their God. And so that they would know what he was like and know how to live as his people, he gathered them at Mount Sinai, where he was giving them the Ten Commandments we looked at, didn't we? But the law to show God's character and to show how to live as God's people. All of it marvelous. But we saw last week that at the same time as God was giving them the initial directions, initial instructions, initial teaching on what it was to be like as God's people, at the very same time as he was doing that, the people at the bottom of the mountain were building a golden calf, were turning away from the one true God to idols, worshipping this idol, and rejecting God, forgetting all that God had done for them. Well, obviously, God was very angry at that. We read last week, I think, in Exodus chapter 32, verse 10, God said to Moses, "Now leave me alone, so that my anger may burn against the people, that I may destroy them." He threatened to destroy them. So great was their turning away from him. He threatened to bring disaster. But at that point, he relented. Well, now we arrive at this morning's passage. And the passage begins with God saying to Moses in chapter 33, verse 1, "Leave this place, you and the people you brought up out of Egypt, and go up to the land I promised on oath to your forefathers." Well, I mean, that sounds great, doesn't it? It's slightly curious because you'd think if he was giving them the law on Mount Sinai and then they rebelled against him and he forgave them, you'd think he'd then go back to what they were doing. But no, he sort of says, well, no, you just go on your way now. So that's slightly strange, but I suppose it might be a good thing. And in verse 2, he says, "I'll send you an angel before you and drive out all the various nations currently in the land," which sounds good, doesn't it? Verse 3, "Go up to the land flowing with milk and honey." I mean, that sounds good, doesn't it, as well? But suddenly, in verse 3, the great shock, God says, "But I will not go with you." That's it. You can go ahead. I will keep my promises to take you into that land. You go ahead to find that land. That's it. But I'm not giving you any more of my law now. No, that's over. You just go. And I'm not going with you. The great surprise here is God is sending them on their way. And he is abandoning them. They've rejected God. And he is leaving them. Because in one sense, you can never totally escape God's presence, can you? They will still, if they make it to the land, still enjoy God's blessing of rain and of sunshine, of crops and of health and so on. But their relationship with God here is ending. God is saying, no more will you be my people. And frankly, if they enter the land without God, then that's not much good either, is it really? I mean, the land was only a blessing because it was with God as their God, having that relationship. There's not much point if he's not there. So why is it then that God is saying, go, but I'm not going with you? Well, verse 3 explains it if you read on. God says, I will not go with you because you are a stiff-necked people and I might destroy you on the way. Is it that God is being vindictive? Well, no, he is concerned because he says, I might destroy you. Their problem is, he says, that they are stiff-necked, which is to say they're stubborn, that they won't turn back to him. They will continue to live their lives the way they want to live them. They don't heed rebuke. They're stiff-necked. And God is concerned because he knows that he is a holy God. And when such sinful people come into his presence, that makes him angry, rightly so, and punishment breaks out. God is implacably opposed to evil, and he will inevitably bring destruction on those who choose to reject him. The picture here is not of God as vindictive or spiteful, but of God who is gracious. He leaves them to go their own way because he cares about them. He doesn't want them to be destroyed. And hence he says they are better off without him. They are better off not in his presence. Because the more they know about God, the longer they hang around at Sinai hearing of God's ways, the more culpable they will be of their sin. And since he knows they will continue to sin, they're better off not knowing any more. The shock here is that sinful people are better off outside God's presence. Well, what does that teach us about God? It shows that he's both gracious on the one hand and holy. He's both loving and just. He's the one who cares about people so much, and yet simultaneously the one who can destroy them in his holiness. The two sides of God are held together. Now, this sounds quite surprising to many people, but the concept's not really unfamiliar from everyday life. You know, if in winter your house is cold, you may decide to turn the fire on to warm yourself up. And the fire is a good thing, isn't it? It provides heat and warmth, and you may enjoy sitting in front of the fire, basking in its warm glow. But suppose your clothes are flammable. You know, dressing gowns and pyjamas often have that little label inside them, don't they, saying they're flammable and you shouldn't get too close to the fire. Because if you're wearing flammable clothes, then sitting next to a fire is a bad idea. The same fire that was supposed to provide you with warmth could set fire to you and kill you. And so the same fire can either warm you or destroy you. According to what you're wearing, you may be better off out in the cold than being too close to the presence of the fire. Or look at it another way. I've just got back from holidays, as you know. And one thing about holidays is that somehow, and I don't know how this happens, but somehow whenever you go on holiday, no matter where you are in the world, you always end up in souvenir shops, don't you? And they always have those little signs saying, breakages must be paid for. Same wherever you go. Now, the shop may be a very pleasant place to be. You may enjoy browsing through all the little trinkets. But suppose there's a really naughty, disobedient child who keeps running around the shop, picking things up. Now, that child is actually better off outside the shop, since breakages must be paid for. It's not good to have an unruly child in the presence of a shop where there's the threat of judgment, is it? The one shop can both be a great place to be and for others a place that they're better off going nowhere near. And so here in our passage, God says that sinful people are actually better off outside his presence. Suppose we fast forward from there into the future. What will happen to these people when they die? What will happen when they face God's judgment seat and their eternal destiny is decided? Well, some say that God will just overlook the way that people have rejected him, that God will just welcome people into heaven regardless. But this passage doesn't seem to indicate that God is like that, does it? He doesn't just overlook their sin. Didn't do it then, and he probably won't do it in the future. Seems very unlikely, doesn't it? Far more probable from this passage, it seems that God will throw people out of his presence, out of the place of relationship with him. Not everyone will find a home in heaven. These people who've turned away from God, who have chosen to live their lives without recognizing God as Lord over them, they cannot expect that God will welcome them into heaven as though nothing had happened. God's practice is the opposite. He removes sinful people from his presence. And what was true then is surely true today. Now, this picture of being removed from God's presence is the way that hell is often explained. It is explained as the place where God is absent, such that if you imagine all the good things in this world, any good sentiment, any good thought, any good feeling, any good impulse, even if not acted upon, take all that good out, because all good things come from God, and you're left with the absence of God, being thrown out of God's presence in a place which is really dreadful. Actually, the Bible pictures hell as worse than that. What could be worse than being cast out of God's presence? To be thrown into God's presence, but yet be still as a sinful person. Remember, the reason for casting them out of his presence here was for his kindness, that they may not be destroyed. But people can't escape God for all eternity. You see, in the future, when God's presence and God's glory are everywhere, they won't be able to escape him, will they? They will experience being with him eternally. But that experience won't be a happy one. It won't be the joy of being in God's glory and God's majesty, but rather the awful experience of feeling God's anger and God's punishment eternally. The punishment which God spared them then, very graciously, cannot be evaded forever. Now, hell is real, and we would rather not think about it. But since God is implacably opposed to evil, when evil people come into his presence, they will necessarily face his punishment and destruction. And we shouldn't imagine that God will somehow overlook this rebellion against him, because all of us, everyone in the world, will one day enter God's presence. And for those who've turned away from him and gone their own way, that presence will be a terrible experience. Well, let's see how the people react, shall we, in verses 4 to 6. As for when the people heard these distressing words, and they are distressing, aren't they? They began to mourn, and no one put on any ornaments. Then on verse 6, so the Israelites stripped off their ornaments at Mount Horeb, which is another word for Sinai, another name for Sinai. Their ornaments, if you remember, were what? Oh, their necklaces and their cufflinks and their earrings and all that sort of stuff, were what they had made into the golden calf before that we saw last week. And so now they're saying, we're turning away from that, all our mistake. We'll get rid of all our ornaments, all our jewellery and everything. But it's a bit late, really, isn't it? I mean, the words stable, door, horse and bolted sort of spring to mind, don't they? It's not. It's too late for that. So is there going to be a way for them out of this dreadful situation? Well, in the second part of the passage we looked at, verses 12 to 17, we see Moses entering into negotiations with God. They're delicate negotiations, and they proceed carefully. Moses opens the discussion in verse 12. Moses said to the Lord, it says, "You have been telling me, lead these people, but you have not let me know whom you will send with me. You have said, I know you by name, and you have found favor with me. If then you are pleased with me, teach me your way so I may know you and continue to find favor with you. Remember that this nation is your people." Well, basically, he's reminding God that God had chosen to lead the Israelites out of slavery in Egypt and into the promised land. And he points out that he, Moses, can't do that unless God is there to guide him. And furthermore, Moses can't enjoy God's favor anymore if Moses goes off with the people out of God's presence. Moses needs God to go with him. Well, God agrees on that, and so we read in verse 14, "The Lord replied, my presence will go with you, and I will give you rest." But notice that he hasn't agreed to go with the Israelites. He's only agreed to go with Moses. "I will go with you, Moses," he says. "I will give you rest." But there's no obligation on anything to do with the people. At this point in the negotiations, God is still saying it's better that he doesn't go with the people because he may destroy them, but he will go with Moses. So Moses now extends his argument in verses 15 and 16, arguing not just for himself now, but arguing for the whole people. We read in verse 15, "Moses said to God, If your presence does not go with us, do not send us up from here. How will anyone know that you are pleased with me and with your people unless you go with us? What else will distinguish me and your people from all the other people on the face of the earth? He's pointing out that the Israelites are God's chosen people, and unless God goes with them, there won't be anything special about them to show that they belong to God. And so he's saying God ought to go with them, so his people are marked out as being different. Well, once again, God agrees with Moses. So he says in verse 17, I will do the very thing you have asked. But notice the second half of that verse. He doesn't do this because of anything good or attractive about the people. He only does it because of Moses. He says, I'll do the thing you have asked because I am pleased with you and I know you by name. Saw the film Sweet November a few weeks back. Thankfully, it's not at the cinema anymore. It's not a good film to see. Don't get it on video. But one of the main characters in that is a top high-flying advertising executive. He's one of the best in the business. And this guy doesn't work on his own. He has a partner, a sidekick, and they work as a team to get everything done. Now, frankly, this partner's not that great, not that talented, really. He's okay, but he's not a patch on the main guy. Well, about two-thirds of the way through the film, this top advertising executive receives a job offer from a rival ad firm. They want him to join their team, but they only want him. They don't want his partner. But they recognise that he works closely with this other guy. He has all the brains and all the flair. He's the one that they want, but they know that he works as a team, and so they have to offer to employ the partner as well. He's the one that they want, and if they want to get him, they have to employ his partner. Well, so be it. They don't want the partner, but they'll take him, as long as they get the guy they're after. That's what's going on here. God is willing to go with Moses. And if that means the rest of the people are there as well, well, then so be it. Moses is the only one who has any favour with God here, not the people. I should explain as a slight aside that Moses doesn't get God to change his mind in this discussion. This is what God had intended all along. But suppose God had just gone along with them straight after the golden calf incident and just not said anything about it, not kept up a fuss. Well, that would have left the people thinking that it doesn't matter if they rebel against God, because at the end of the day, God's going to go along with everyone anyway. God always overlooks past misdeeds. But that would have been a misunderstanding. So God allowed this process to happen because he wanted them to understand two things. Firstly, as we've seen, sinful people are better off outside God's presence, since God's anger would destroy them. And secondly, they need to see that if God is to go with them, despite their sinfulness, that will only be possible if a righteous person, such as Moses, pleads their case. To be in God's presence and not be destroyed, sinful people need a righteous mediator. Let's fast forward again to the end of time. We saw before that those people who turn away from God will be eternally shut out of a relationship with him. But now it appears that there is a single possibility of having our sin discounted and entering God's presence in heaven after all. If there is someone who God favours, who will plead our case, then it may be possible to enter God's presence despite our sinfulness, not because of anything we've done, but simply because of that one person. It may be possible to enjoy an eternal relationship with God without being destroyed. Well, you probably guessed by now, this passage is, of course, pointing forward to Jesus. Jesus, who enjoys complete favour with God, who will plead the case for his people, that they may enter heaven and not suffer God's punishment. Of course, this situation in Exodus is a bit of a fudge, really, isn't it? I mean, if you look closely, there's lots of things not quite right about it. God dwells with the people again, even though their sin has not been atoned for, and he accepts the mediation of Moses, even though Moses is not a perfect person himself, is he? He still sins. But that is a shadow. It points forward to the need all the more for Jesus to be a complete atonement for our sin, to be a perfect, righteous mediator. And if we want eternity to be a positive experience, if we want to be in a wonderful relationship with God for all time and escape his anger and his punishment, then we need Jesus. There is no other way to have God's presence dwell with us without being destroyed. Well, often we read passages of the Bible and it tells us something that we should do as a result. For example, we may read about the golden calf incident, and it may cause us to acknowledge our own sinfulness and resolve in the future to live differently, to live obediently to God, to worship him alone. Well, today's passage doesn't tell us so much something to do as something we need to acknowledge, something that's uncomfortable to acknowledge since it flies in the face of what people in our culture tend to think. We need to recognise that the threat of God punishing sinful people is real, and we will not be able to evade it. The threat of hell is a real one, which affects our friends, our neighbours, our colleagues, and even our family. This passage asks us to acknowledge that in our thinking and not to deny it.